Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruiak. There There is the astonishing, award-winning, and best-selling novel by Tommy Orange, who grew up in Oakland but lives now with his wife and 7-year-old son in the foothills of Angels Camp, California. This novel is his first. It's a book that he says he actually just wanted to have published so that he could get a teaching job. But this book has done so much more than that. The story unfolds with an ensemble of about a dozen main characters, young and old, boys and girls, men and women. Some are native, some are non-native, and their lives are woven together in ways that aren't made clear until a final climactic and violent scene that unfolds at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. Tommy was here in September for a CAP Radio Reads event, which I guest hosted for Donna Appadoni. Our conversation was recorded before a live audience. Today, you are going to hear part of that before the podcast version of that night is released. I started by asking Tommy why he thinks his book has captivated people everywhere so intensely.
I hate that the first place my mind goes around this question is Trump. But it's totally related because he's made people make the decision about what do they value and who do they side with and what do they want to do about it. And the book sold right after Standing Rock was a big thing. Native people aren't in national attention very often, but it's always when we have been in a major way, it's always been followed by a boom in interest ever since the first Native American literary renaissance, in which we took over Alcatraz, and Marlon Brando had Sashi and Little Feather not accept the Academy Award. Mm-hmm. That was the first boom. And then there was a lot of attention, and then not that much. And then in the 90s, Dances with Wolves won a lot of awards, and that had the same effect. And that, so Standing Rock and Trump, like, these are factors that I can't help but think of. Of course, I'm not just going to be like the merit of my work. It's not the case. A lot of amazing books come out every year. A lot are missed. A lot are found later. Our times, the political times, and having people want to listen more to marginal voices. And I think that's the main thing. I mean, I have a lot of other weird side theories I'm not going to get into, but...
Why not? Give me one.
Well, it's different for each country, too, because it's been translated into like 24 different languages. And I was just in Germany, and they have kind of their own weird interest in Native people. And it's doing well there. So they had a guy named Karl May, who's a novelist, who had never been to America and never met a Native person. And he sold like 40 million books. And so it was like a reverse of Tonto and Lone Ranger. It was Winnetou, and I don't know what the sidekick was, but he was a white cowboy. And the main guy was Winnetou, who was a Native guy, out of Karl May's imagination. And everyone loved Native people because of growing up reading these stories. So the theory for German people is that's related to this very specific thing. I don't want to necessarily get into any of my side theories.
You said something about a renaissance, and there are people calling you the new Native renaissance. How does that play to you? What does that mean?
I don't love it, because the renaissance has always meant like a resurgence in interest in Native people and matters, and then it's like a trend that dies off, and I would rather have a sustainable interest in what is our country's relationship to the people who were here before, and what is our national identity, and how does it relate to how we ended up a nation? That should be a lasting way that we reimagine who we are as Americans. Our relationship to the people who were here and how we acquired the land and all that we did should be a lasting formation of the American identity, and not some like romanticized thing that we can think of sometimes when we're like, oh, what are they doing again? And then go back to thinking that we don't exist anymore.
Did the concept of the book come to you in sort of a moment, sort of an idea, and then unfolded from there?
It did. It was maybe a couple of weeks after I found out I was going to be a father, and we were, me and my wife were driving to LA to see this very crazy rapper and pianist named Chilly Gonzalez. And as a lot of great ideas can come from not thinking, this sort of like popped into my head, this idea of having all these lives converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. And I just became convinced by that premise. And powwows are such a great place for an urban Indian story to be told, because they're contemporary and traditional feeling, and they're intertribal. And there's just a, you know, there's a lot of resonance for the urban Indian to be told in that context, and then for it to be Oakland, an Oakland Coliseum. I'd also known that I wanted to write a novel about Oakland, because there's not that much out there.
Had you been to a powwow before?
My dad is full-blood Cheyenne from Oklahoma, grew up in a rural town, small town, and he didn't grow up going to powwows, so he didn't really raise us going. We went to a few in my childhood, and one memorable one when I was 18, I don't know why he took us randomly, to one in Berkeley at a gymnasium. Well, I guess this is why, because a kid I grew up with, we only grew up with one other Indian family in Oakland, and they were the Browns. And us being the Oranges, I knew there was some connection to last name in Indian families, but I knew there had to be something else to it. And you know, he never had a good explanation as to why we were the Oranges.
That was going to be one of my questions. Where did that last name come from?
It's a Cheyenne name, but there's a lot of mysteries to last names when it comes to colonization and black people and tribal people who don't have a history of last names and surnames and patriarchy embedded in the same way into their culture. So it's a sordid history, and there's a lot of different reasons why last names would end up kind of weird. And so I don't know what ours is. At one point in kindergarten, my mom has orange hair, and we had an orange van at the time. We would get dropped off two blocks from school because my sisters were mortified by the idea of being the Oranges and being, and I didn't care. I mean, I was in kindergarten.
You didn't care. You were little.
I wasn't. Yeah.
Do you have a native name?
Yeah. My dad gave us all Cheyenne names. So mine translates as birds sing in the morning. A not very good Cheyenne version of that, because we didn't grow up speaking my language, is Vigas Melnistos. So he just woke up one morning very early and was inspired to name me that.
There was a finalist for the 2019 Pulitzer Prize. It recently won the 2019 American Book Award, as well as the 2019 Penn Hemingway Award. It won the 2018 National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Prize and the 2019 Center for Fiction First Novel Prize. Also, it won a gold medal for first fiction by the California Book Awards. There was a finalist for the 2019 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. It was longlisted for the National Book Award. And it is a finalist for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, which will be awarded November 3rd.
Thank you.
What is this book for Native people? What are you hearing back?
Well, it's just like a modern depiction is hungry for there being no contemporary modern depictions that get popular attention, I think, is a combination of those things. Because there are a lot of people doing modern cool stuff in the Native world, but the attention doesn't happen. So my book's gotten a lot of attention, and that means there can be a shift in the way people think about Native people, and it can stop being so static and so historical and so monolithic, and it can have a range, because the book has a range of proximities to Native identity, and it's definitively contemporary, and that's just not something we've been allowed in the popular consensus and the way people think of Native people. And we're not so worried about what people think of Native people, except that we've been defined by the outside world so much, and this affects policies, and this affects the way we live our lives. So we have to be at least paying attention to what the world thinks of us. We have to.
If you would read this passage, this is from the prologue, which is a whole setting of power in and of itself. I think your use of the prologue is something that, for you personally as a writer, is an important part of structure.
Well, I knew I wanted to write a prologue before I knew what I wanted it to be about. And then once I, because prologues can break all the rules of whatever world you set up once you start the world of the novel. Prologues can be anything, and this is why I knew I wanted to write one. And so once I realized I wanted to write about sort of like an urban native contextual manifesto of like, what does it mean and where does it come from, because it feels so absent in literature, it brought me through history and my own personal hearing of my dad's stories, and then eventually this Indian head theme and this finding on the internet of a telling of this Cheyenne story, this traditional old Cheyenne story that's very strange. My grandpa, who I never met, I found it on the internet. It's his telling of it that I incorporated into the prologue.
Really?
But this is the part that you asked me to read. When they first came for us with their bullets, we didn't stop moving even though the bullets moved twice as fast as the sound of our screams. And even when their heat and speed broke our skin, shattered our bones, skulls pierced our hearts, we kept on. Even when we saw the bullets send our bodies flailing through the air like flags, like the many flags and buildings that went up in place of everything we knew this land to be before. The bullets were premonitions, ghosts from dreams of a hard, fast future. The bullets moved on after moving through us, became the promise of what was to come, the speed and the killing, the hard, fast lines of borders and buildings. They took everything and ground it down to dust as fine as gunpowder. They fired their guns into the air in victory, and strays flew out into the nothingness of histories written wrong and meant to be forgotten.
How young is too young to learn and read this? Is this book now in high schools, or have you heard from high school teachers yet?
I went to a high school in Wisconsin, and this teacher had sort of pushed through some grant to get the money for the book, and she made it happen for her high school. And I've heard of other similar stories, so it's definitely happening in high schools. And that same teacher, I went, it was my first high school event, and I'm so scared of high schoolers. The first thing I want to say when I get offered by my lecture agent, like, this high school wants you to come, I'm like, no.
Why?
The high schoolers are scary.
It wasn't so long ago for you.
It was like 20 years ago. No, but I always dread them, and then they're like the best events. Mm. So a kid, a native kid from a visit to a Wisconsin high school, didn't speak up and wanted to because he felt just too shy or whatever. She sent a note from him in an email. He would never even would have thought that he would see himself on the page of stuff to read in school. And he said it changed him as a reader, and that he'll never be the same kind of student again because he was able to find himself in the books. And that was, you know, that was an amazing moment for me. And so I keep doing high school things because of that. But it's scary every time.
How do you feel this book changing you and your family with your wife and your son, and what the horizon for your life might be?
I don't know. I mean, right now it feels very practical. Like, I thought I'd be a renter my whole life, and we just bought a house. And that, you know, that's a crazy change in reality. We no longer have to worry about money, which is my lifetime relationship to money, was just being worried about it. That's like a really nice thing. It's a very serious change in the way that you think about the day-to-day and what's next month. and will we have a place to live? Can we pay rent? These are like, you know, a lot of stress relievers. In terms of what it means that I'm like some kind of known author, it's still too early to tell what it will do, if it's going to be like damaging or good. I don't know. I would hope my son would eventually, it would be a good thing, but fame and success don't always do that to people. So I try to stay grounded in like running and spending time with family and continuing to write. And if I can do all those things, I know I can stay in a good place.
So your story is to be continued.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out.
Author Tommy Orange in September of 2019, talking about his award-winning, best-selling debut novel, There, There. And whether you are a constant reader or rarely a reader, this is a book not to miss, or you can listen to it as an audiobook. And you can hear more of our conversation in the Cap Radio Reads podcast episode, which isn't up yet, but will be posted soon. And here's a bonus bit of information. Tommy told us that night that the TV series rights have been bought by what he called a big company that I can't reveal yet, with a director who is Native American. He said there's still a long journey for the production to end up on TV, but he said it would be amazing to have that happen. Tommy Orange, his debut novel from 2018 is There, There. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.